Hi, you're listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.
Yeah, thank you. Can you hear me at the back? All right. If you can't, can you gesticulate at some point, yeah? I'm counting on you. You keep shaking your head or you're nodding your head. So, first thing, being an expert. I've been in the program, I saw it as an expert, but I've always remembered, I'm still always learning. Somebody years ago told me what an expert was. It's an ex is a has-been and a spurt is a drip under pressure. So for me, I'm always learning, and this is actually fairly, since the last 10 years, a fairly new subject for me as well. So I'm just going to talk on quite a sort of dry subject generally. House renovation, what we need to do to houses to make them energy efficient and stop wasting energy. And it's an important but fairly dull subject until you get into it, and then you get really animated, and then everyone starts yawning, and you know, this is the usual thing. So I will try to keep it going a little bit. So, in the light of climate, what we might call climate breakdown, not climate change anymore, climate breakdown, you know, what can we do about how much should we do to our houses? And what exactly, what does that mean in pragmatic terms? So we know that climate change is becoming more prominent. The climate is changing. That's very clear. It's getting hotter. We've got about 1 degree Celsius higher since the 1850 to 1900 recording period. Hottest recorded years are being the very recent years now. We've got more extreme, intense weather events. We can see that. Glacier mass is reducing. We've got a 20-meter water equivalent reduction in glacier mass. A lot more activism and more awareness and so on. So what's the cause of all this? I think we all know that. It's carbon emissions and methane. Carbon emissions have gone up since 1960, it was 320 parts per million, and it's gone up to 400-ish. Something like that. So a massive spike in carbon emissions. It's not the only thing that's causing climate change. Methane is being released from the permafrost and all that's contributing, but CO2 is quite a big thing. So during this session, what I want to cover is what contribution our houses make to that CO2 carbon dioxide problem, and what should we do about it, or what can we do about it. So first off, UK carbon emissions. Again, I had to do a bit of my research on this to get the figures right, but in last year, the UK's carbon emissions were 490 million tonnes. That was from the Committee of Climate Change. Now, what does that actually mean? Well, not a lot to me, but we're about 1% of the world's emissions, and in terms of the EU 28, we're second after Germany. So we in the UK are quite responsible for a lot of carbon within the EU and even in the world. So housing's contribution to the CO2 emissions, how much is it in the UK? Something like 18%, something like that. So it's quite significant, you know, a fifth of the total CO2 comes from mainly heating of the houses. So it's responsible for a lot of emissions, and we need to do something about that. It's not the only major player. We've got transport, so aviation, 8%, shipping and service transport. I think that's cars and things, that's 20-something. You know, so all the sort of transportation and everything is about 34%, so that's another big one. But housing is a big contributor. So science says that we need to stop our emissions. It's not about, reducing carbon emissions. It's actually about stopping them, which means, you know, our carbon emissions are going up and up and up, and they need to flatten off completely, as in stop. They can't just keep going up slightly. That's not going to work. From where we are now, 100% cut. Currently, as a nation, we're off target to meet our I think it's the fourth and fifth carbon budget. So the fourth one starts in 2023 till 2027. And the fifth one is 2028 to 2032. And we're off target. We're kind of just about in target at the moment, but we're going to go out of target. The Committee of Climate Change says the government is not pretty much not doing much. They had a lot of headline policies suggested, and the government's only implemented one of them last year. So the government's being fairly useless about this. In my view, you know, I see a lot of words and headlines and strap lines and talks and presentations and websites, but we need action. This is not going to change without action. So for housing, what does this level of reduction mean that we need to reduce down to zero? What does that mean? The ACB is a very good organization. It's an association of environment conscious building. You can join it as anyone, a private individual, as a company or whatever. And they're trying to muddle through and figure out for houses, how far do we need to go to get the carbon to the right point, and what do we need to do to get there? They've done some modeling on that, and they figure out, we can get to around, our housing is around the 90 million tons of CO2 out of the 400 and something million. And we can get that down to around 40 million tons if we have a very rigorous deep retrofit program for 22.5 million homes. But there's still 40 million tons left, and that's based on, if we all use gas, that's still a carbon source. So that's, if we need to decarbonize our heat sources as well, that means going renewable and heat source pumps and so on. And then that'll take us down to about 20 million tons. And the other last 20 million will be decarbonizing the manufacture of products and construction methods. So those two things, those two last things, we can't really do too much about right now. But what we can do is the major part, going down from 90 to 40 million tons, deep retrofit of millions of houses. So that's very difficult to do. It's very difficult to do one, let alone 22.5 million of them. But that's what we're going to discuss at 8 p.m. over there a bit more. This energy efficiency is as big as the gain, so that's where we're going to go now in this discussion. We need to get... what does that actually mean? Where exactly do we need to head to in terms of our heating for different house types? Maybe a bungalow, maybe a terrace house, maybe a detached house. What does that mean? Where do we need to get to? The ACB, has done some modeling for that. And what we use is something called space heating demand. This is as a sort of parameter. So this is the amount of energy you need to heat the air in a building. It's measured in kilowatt hours, which is an amount of quantity of energy for every square meter of floor area per year. So for different house types, there's these kind of targets. So they've kind of come and done some modeling, and they've come around to around about, for a bungalow, something like 75-ish kilowatt hours per square meter per year. A terraced house, something around 40. Now, why would you say a bungalow has higher? Well, a bungalow is much harder to get energy efficient than a terraced house. And a semi-detached house, something like 44 kilowatt hours. So this is the kind of targets we need to aim for. The ACB, again, they did some modeling. I think it was together with the Green Party. The Green Party had a very ambitious policy for getting passive house renovations done, and to actually see, is that pragmatic, and how, in the ACB's experience, it's not really pragmatic to get to passive house for retrofits. Very, very hard. It's possible, but for most people, not. So what level would it be possible to? And they came up with these targets, 75, 40, 44, things like that. And a certain number of houses needed to be retrofitted in order to get to our carbon target. But they calculated not just that, they'd also taken into account things like the number of listed buildings that were not going to be renovated, the rate of demolitions, the rate of conversions from commercial buildings to non-domestic buildings, the rate of building new homes and everything, and the carbon burp, they call it, which is basically when you're retrofitting or renovating something, you use materials and energy to do the renovation. That's carbon again. So taking all that into account, they've done some modeling and figured out that these sort of targets will almost get there if we can. So if we're talking about these targets, let's let's maybe have a bit of interaction here. So we talked about the bungalow needing a space heating demand of 75 kilowatt-hours per square meter per year. So just what does that actually mean in terms of the number of units of gas, for example? So I've just taken here, I did calculation for an average bungalow, maybe 67 square meters bungalow. That would be equivalent for around 5,000 kilowatt-hours in a year. Does anybody live in a bungalow here and also know what their energy bill is? Or the number of kilowatt hours and the number of gas units? Does anybody know that or want to? No? What about anybody living in a terrace house? Does anybody live in a terrace house? Does anybody live in a house of some description? Okay, terraced house. This is also, it's not pointing out how bad your house is, because most of us, I would say 90%+, are living in bad houses. Okay, so it's normal status. Mid-terraced house, 40 kilowatt hours would be this is one with two floors, for example, with 84 square meter, roughly. Kilowatt hours per year, 3,360 I got, or 106 gas units. Gas units, I think, is in cubic feet or something, isn't it? That's what I make it. So is that anywhere near what people in the mid-terrace are using now, or are using a lot more? Okay, so people living in a mid-terrace, do you know how many kilowatt hours or gas units you use in a year? Yeah, that would be more like semi-detached-ish kind of thing. Yeah, but do you know what you're for? Okay, well, when you get it, it's either kilowatt hours on the number of gas units. Gas units is the stuff going through the gas meter, you know.
4,000?
No, no, no.
That's a 5,000 a month.
1,000 a month, so 12,000 a year. If it was 4,000 a year, you would have been just about on target. But is that your annual gas bill? Well, 1,000. Yeah, but do you know in a year what you've used, for example? But this is the thing, I don't know if anybody knows what, maybe you just pay the bills and 6,000 to 10,000 what? Kilowatt hours in a year. And are you living in a two-bedroom semi? Three-bedroom semi, okay. So in a semi-detached house, I mean, I've got here an example, 80 square meter-ish floor area, you know, two floor, 3,500 kilowatt hours is what we need to aim for. And you're between 6 and 10. So this is kind of normal. A lot of people are much more than that, you know, more than 10,000. Yeah, that's gas. Yes, but most of the gas in your scenario will be used for heating a bit more. No? What is the gas used for? Oh, right, okay, yeah. Okay, but you're still you're still using 6,000 to 10,000 kilowatt hours of gas per year? No, you're not, okay. Okay, got it. Anybody else know where their figures? Anyway, no. Well, this is a bit, gets into a bit of the nitty gritty, but this is the kind of figures, you know, you're somewhere between, depending on your house type, 3,000 to 5,000 kilowatt hours in a year, if you're on gas, for heating and hot water. So this is kind of what we're looking at. And many houses are using much more than that. What I'm going to do now is just to go through a few different examples of four different examples of house types: bungalow. I've got a mid terrace, a detached house, and a semi-detached. And we'll look at the retrofit on each one, what was done, and how much difference that made. And might give you an idea about the scale of what's needed. This is all basically assuming that after the retrofit is done, you'll be able to turn the thermostat and have it 20 degrees all year. Not to fluctuate cold and hot. And the idea of all of this is to look at what scale of measures we need, okay? So bungalow, first off, they're more difficult, they're detached, they're single story, so the shape of it doesn't lend itself very well to saving energy. You lose more energy. So we've got a target of something around 75 or less, if we can get there. This was a bungalow in Bolton, 1970s build, 100 square meters, sort of big L shape, cavity wall. It had lone mineral wool inside the cavity wall already. It had a block inner, it had a brick outer. It had some floor insulation already in. It was a solid floor, but it had some of that nasty polyurethane insulation on the floor, but not everywhere. Some cupboards didn't have it, some had it, and so on. It was not so drafty. If you do a draft, if you want to know how leaky your house is, you can do an air test. So you get a guy with a fan, you shut all the windows and everything, and you put it in the fan in the front door, and you crank it up to 50 pascals, is about equivalent five millimeter of water pressure on the house, and you see how much air can come in. It'll suck the air out, and you can go around feeling where the air is coming. And basically, we want to get it down to around under 1.5 air changes in an hour. So it means if you run the fan for a whole hour, not more than 1.5 air volumes of your house would be able to be sucked out the door in an hour under pressure. Of course, when you back calculate it to normal outside wind pressure, it's less than that. But, you know, this gives us some indication. So this house wasn't so leaky. It was about 8 air changes an hour. She had already underfloor heating installed. So there were a bit of a head start to some of the measures already done. We weren't starting from scratch. But if she wanted to be 20 degrees Celsius in the heating season, she would have a space heating demand of 180 kilo hours in a square meter. And we needed to get that down to at least 75. So in the end, we actually did manage to get it down to 57, which is actually better than target. But what did we have to do to get to that point? So the external facing walls had to be insulated, and so they were insulated with an external wall insulation, expanded polystyrene of some type, 120 millimeters of it, so this much insulation going on all the outside wall, and also negotiating with the contractor to take it right up to the top of the leaf, so past the sort of the rotting soffit boards and the gutter, and take it right up to the top of the outside wall, and it's got to connect with your loft insulation, is that, because otherwise you'll have a thermal bridge up there. So there was a bit of a negotiation along those lines. The insulation carrying on to ground level, otherwise you'll have a thermal bridge there. And that was a compromise, because we should have gone a bit below ground, because you, when you go below ground, you can cut off a bit of the heat, because the ground insulates, the walls don't. So that little junction there, but we would go down to ground level with another kind of insulation, which was not wouldn't take on water. Air tightness was going to be very airtight, so it was fairly okay. It was plastered internal walls, not so hard to, you know, fairly good plaster finish. So that was airtight, but around the windows would have to be chipped off, taped and replastered. And all of the ceilings would have to be battened out, membraned or airtight OSB on, and make all of the ceilings airtight. So a bit of faffing around with airtightness, but not so bad. A whole house ventilation system with heat recovery. So that's basically a big unit that hums away, doesn't make much noise, but it sucks air out of the wet rooms and the kitchen and plops it into the living areas and the bedrooms. And it recovers the heat while it's at it. So you get good fresh air, good air quality and so on, but without wasting too much energy. Most of the windows were already done, so they were okay, except the front door. That had to be put in. Hot water cylinder and the underfloor heating needed some tweaking, so quite a few thousand spent on that. Bit of loft insulation added. One of the thermal bridges had to be done between the loft and the gable wall. We had to put something along there to stop the heat loss on that junction. And while she was at it, she converted the garage to a bedroom. So all of that was costing, and this is the conundrum with retrofit, $64,000. That was a non-DIY version. So she was not able to do, actually it's still in progress, this retrofit. She's not able to do all of that herself. So the more you have to contract something out, labor is 60 to 70% of the cost. So then the cost will go up. So per square meter, about £635 for that one. If we say per square meter, what does it cost globally? And 22% of all of those measures were considered non-energy efficiency, as in, you know, there's always a non-energy efficiency thing that we're going to do that is going to use some of our budget up. Okay, so that gives you an idea for that bungalow. So we went from 180 down to 57 for 64 grand. all right? Victorian mid-terrace, solid walls, brick inner, brick outer, not much space between, filled with all kinds of mortise knots and bits and bobs. So it's a solid wall. We have to be a bit careful about insulating that. Windows have just been replaced with nice looking but not very good ones. Good level of insulation in the loft, so we didn't have to do anything there much. There was an extension for the bathroom that had been put on who knows when, 1970s probably, with hardly anything in the loft there, so that had to be dealt with. There was no ventilation. It was very drafty in the open fireplaces. And there was an old boiler. So if she had wanted to heat it to 20 degrees, she wasn't. We estimated an average house temperature of 15.5 degrees in the heating season, because you would just heat one or two rooms. But if she wanted to heat the whole thing, it would have taken 260 kilowatt-hours a square meter, and she needs to get that down to around 40. In the end, we got it down to 89, so we haven't missed the target, but we still got done a pretty good job on that. But still, you can see how hard it is. So to get to that, what has to happen is that this time we insulated internally the walls with a wood fiber board, which is something that can manage moisture risk a little bit better. We painted the outside, not painted, but we put some transparent capillary block on the outside walls. Sort of, it repels driven rain a little bit. Air tightness, so we had a lot of work on air tightness. Floor voids, you had to cut through the ceiling, cut down the floorboard from above. Those floor voids are very leaky, they're open, unplastered brickwork, a lot of air leaking through there. Got to plaster those up, make them all airtight. A lot of jiggery pokery with air tightness there. Ventilation unit had to be put in. Hardly any space to put it, but we managed to put it in the bathroom in the ceiling. Again, jiggery pokery. Loft insulation, had to put that in the bathroom extension. There was a solid floor everywhere, but it was beyond budget to drill it up. So we put 20 millimeter of some kind of waterproof insulation down that was just enough with a bit of floorboard to not obstruct the door. So that took the edge off the floor. But again, there's always compromises. The party, but yeah, we had a lot of different thermal bridges to sort out. A thermal bridge is basically a junction where the heat can bypass or go quicker. So sometimes you have to do things to those junctions to mitigate the heat loss. Jiggery pokery again. Windows were not done because they'd just been done badly, and the boiler was replaced. So all of that was costing, drum roll, 48 grand. Oh, so it's cheaper. But still, per square meter, it's coming out at £788. Because it was not DIY, it was contracted out work. And a quarter of all of that budget was non-energy efficiency measures. Okay? So that gives you an idea. We went from what would have been 260 down to 89, but it cost that much. And a lot of work and hassle. Third example, modern 1990 detached house. Is anybody living in one of those? Probably, yeah, several. So this one was 120 square meter, cavity wall. It had blown mineral wool in the cavity. It had a block inner. It had a brick outer. But when I say inner and outer, I'm talking about the wall. So, you know, cavity walls were made originally to sort of try to separate the internal space from driven rain. So you'd have a wet outer surface and a drier inner one. And that's how they were built, you see. There's already a bit of insulation, a bit of expanded polystyrene under the existing floor. So that was something, but not much of it, 30 millimeter or something like that. There were some good wooden windows already and some bad ones, so some had to be replaced. There was no ventilation. It was very drafty. When the fan test was done, it was 11 air changes. So 11 air volumes per hour would disappear out the front door with a fan if that kept running for an hour. A good level of loft insulation there. But they had a solar hot water system that needed revamping and dealing with for, you know, quite a lot of money. So if they had continued to heat that to 20 degrees, they would have been at 200 kilowatt hours, and they needed to get down to, for a detached house, something like 40 to 45, something like that. In the end, we managed to get it down to about 64. So not a bit under target. It's because basically the floor was already done with a bit of insulation and they don't want to tackle it. Because it's already there, and do we have to do it? But now they're thinking maybe they should. So we'll see where that goes. But this is the problem. When things are done not very good, then you don't want to undo it. But then you're kind of stuck at there, you know. So what do we have to do to get to that level? So internal wood fiber, 140 millimeter in this case on the inner wall. A lot of it was done DIY. So they could save quite a lot of money on that one. Air tightness using intelligent membranes internally in front of the wood fiber, and then battening out, and then plasterboarding. So your wires go in front of your air tightness layer, but behind your plasterboard, and you can put your plugs and everything in that. A ventilation system with heat recovery, again, for that one. A solid floor, yeah. There was a solid floor in the garage. They converted part of the garage before, but that had... that one, it was a suspended floor before, that little bit, and that was going to be converted into a solid floor with insulation in it. This is a retrofit in progress. That's already been done there. The hot water tank was rehabilitated. A wood-burning stove was put in, which wasn't really needed. And floor to exterior, yeah, there's a bit of thermal bridging, jiggery-pokery. So all of that cost, with the DIY components, they were doing a lot of the work themselves, $60,000. But, you know, they were going from quite a lot of floor area to deal with. But per square meter, that was about £500 square meter. And they were only 10% of the budget or so was non-energy efficiency related stuff. Oh, and you might be tired by now, but there's one more example. So a 1970 semi. Anybody living in one of those? Yeah, a couple. I don't know where everybody else is living, on the street or something. But so this was a 74 square meter house, floor area. They had a cavity wall, so a brick outer, block inner. This time it didn't have mineral wool in it. It had these little polystyrene beads in there already. There wasn't much loft insulation, so that would have to be dealt with a bit. There was a existing suspended floor with no insulation. Fairly good windows, but not quite good enough, but they were already there. No ventilation and very drafty, about 12 air volumes per hour. And an old boiler. So if she had kept heating the house, it would be 190 kilowatt hours needed per square meter. And we needed to get that down to 44. And she's got it down to 41. So we're on target. But to get there, what did we have to do? 100 millimeter wood fiber on most of the walls internally, which she could do DIY. And a bit more specialist product, a bit more expensive on some walls where there wasn't much space. Something called Space Therm. It's a plasterboard that's bonded some white fluffy stuff that you can put directly on the wall. And air tightness in front of that was either plaster finish or an airtight membrane with battening. A ventilation unit with heat recovery put in. Suspended floor converted to an insulated floor, a solid insulated floor. So taking all of those joists out, putting in a solid insulated floor with expanded polystyrene. We used expanded polystyrene there because when you took the floorboards up, you realize there's a crawl space, but it's not very deep. And below that, there's concrete again. So you're kind of limited by the space. So we try to maximize the energy efficiency by using some expanded polystyrene in that one. Loft insulation was added. A new front door is being installed at the moment. Before it was sort of inset, you know, with like a little sort of alcove. You sort of go into the building and you have a bit of bedroom floor above you, which is always cold. And then you have the front door, a really bad one. So of course, bring that out. We brought that out to the edge of the outer edge of the building. And that's being done at the moment, which means that that little bit in here is in the warm zone now. She is replacing the boiler with an air source heat pump. Very good. And a bit of jiggery pokery with a thermal bridge along some of the party wall. So what did that cost her? Well, it's going to be around $62,000, we think. Per square meter, about £850 square meter. So that's a mixture of DIY, a mixture of contractors in. So after all of those four examples, you can see the big message from that is this is what we have to do to our houses to get our carbon emissions in line with what science tells us we need to do. and anything less, it won't work. Now, if you say that it's not just not possible, well, then the climate will continue to change. And that's just, that's unfortunately, this is where we are. So it's not enough, it's not good enough to dabble with a bit of loft insulation or, a bit of draft excluders or something. I mean, that's great. It's great, but it's not going to cut it. The kind of emissions reduction we need is so drastic, and it's hard to do. And building physics is what it is. We can be optimistic in our thinking, but physics doesn't really change. I mean, it'd be nice if we could try to do it, but physics is physics. So that's just, we have heat loss. You put heat in, you want to be warm. It'll be lost through the walls if we don't, stop that. So ideally, we want to be comfortable in future. We want to still heat our houses, but we just need to stop them losing heat. So it's a bit of a hard sell. So you heard that difference between the DIY end of things, about £500 a square meter, up to maybe four times that. Maybe the average of something around is between £5,000 a square meter. So this is the kind of budget you'll need. If you're adding extensions and all kinds of other stuff, then maybe £2,000 a square meter, depending on how many gold bathtubs you have and so on. But people always spend stuff when they're doing renovation that's not energy related, So that's why the cost goes up when you. So money is a big problem. People don't have money. They might have a pension pot. They might, but many people don't have that kind of money to be dealing with. So but you can do it in phases. You can do some of the DIY. You can have a sort of a longer term view for the next 10 years to do something, as long as you've got a whole house plan to do that with. So that's one problem: cash, payback. So people talk about payback. Oh, I need to get money back. I'm going to spend all this money on the house. When will it pay off? Well, the answer is, the last calculations I did was somewhere between 80 and 100 years. So if you're doing a new building, then yes, payback is very, very quick. If it's a renovation work, you've got to, yes, you will save on your energy bills. But the small print is you've got to spend an awful lot of money to do that. So payback is not. But anyway, you wouldn't calculate. You wouldn't ask, oh, I'm going to buy a car. What's the payback? You never do that. Or I'm going to buy a gold bathtub. What's the payback? You don't. You just do it. So I think that's just probably a non-issue. But people keep talking about payback. Hassle, upheaval, mess. It is a mess. You probably have to move out, and it's a hassle. And you uncover all kinds of things that you didn't really want to uncover, but you've got to deal with them. That's just how it is. And it will take several months as well. You need good master planning, so somebody needs to figure out what you're going to do, in what sequence, and is this going to actually work, and in terms of moisture risk as well. Older buildings have complicated things, so complicated junctions, solid walls, moisture risk, certain walls in certain directions, windows that don't have lintels above them, rotten bits of things, the roof starts, you didn't know you had to re-roof, and now you do. There's all kinds of funny things going on. Another problem, piecemeal retrofit won't work. So if you imagine, I'll just do a bit of insulation. I'll just put a bit of insulation on the wall, not understanding that you've got to make it airtight. Because if you put insulation on a wall, and this is what I did years ago with my house when I started to do my own renovation, I didn't really understand fully what airtightness was. But if you put insulation on the wall, that's great, and you can try to do it with as few gaps as possible. But air, if you're not putting an air barrier to stop the air moving through the construction, air will still go wherever it used to go. So imagine it was going around maybe through a floor void before. So I've insulated up through the floor void, but the air will still pass through the insulation, get to the cold wall behind it. It's much colder than it used to be now, and it might condense out. So what we don't want is to increase the moisture and possibly mold risk behind our insulation. We've got to stop the air moving, because air takes a lot of moisture very rapidly through small spaces, and it condenses out. So that's what we want to avoid. So you can't just plop a bit of insulation on a wall and think, oh, that's fine. No, you've got to combine that with an airtightness strategy. So a membrane or a plaster layer or something like that. And you've got to think, well, I'm just doing this room now, but I'm going to do upstairs next year. I'm going to do downstairs this year. Well, what about the floor void, right? So where are you going to, you're going to put insulation on this wall. You're going to make it airtight from the floor to where the insulation stops. But when you come to upstairs, you've got to dig down through the floor and marry up your air tightness layer and carry it on up. So there's a little bit, you know, you can do it in phases, but you've got to understand the interlink between insulation and airtightness. And the more rooms you do bit by bit, the more airtight your house becomes. And of course, you know, at a certain point, you need to ventilate it. If you're in a very drafty house, maybe you don't have to do that straight away, but at a certain point, it'll become airtight. You need to put a ventilation unit in to introduce air and regulate the humidity, moisture. So those three things kind of go together. So piecemeal retrofit where you just do one thing at a time, or you just say, oh, I'll just do that and I'm not going to worry about the other things. It doesn't work really. Builders, right. So it's hard to find them. I think as somebody said in recently in Manchester, there are good builders who know about low energy building and air tightness are as rare as rocking horse droppings. That's what he says. It's true. There's hardly any of them about. If you say to an average builder, I've got to make it airtight, and they go, they won't know what you're talking about. So we need to do a lot of training of builders. This is just what we're kind of doing at the moment. But a lot more needs to happen on that. And it's all of this nonsense is going on with a government that doesn't seem to actually put building regulations in place. I mean, we could have tomorrow new buildings, which are not going to, new buildings don't take up a big percentage of the buildings in the coming years, you know, but even those ones could be passive house tomorrow. There's hardly any difference in cost, but in a upfront cost of building a passive house compared with a normal building regs, building regs is not fit for purpose. So there's no reason why that can't happen. And still they dither and do nothing. So imagine how, if we can't just do that for a new build, how on earth can we do something for retrofit, you know? So the government doesn't seem to understand the problem. So we've got 22.5 million homes to renovate deeply, very, very soon, rapidly, with no finance, with all of these hassles and problems. So this is mission impossible, actually, isn't it? I mean, that kind of budget, that kind of money, that kind of hassle for 22.5 million homes. So mission impossible. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to renovate your house, as retrofit it deeply to those targets. So bungalow, 75 kilowatt hours per square meter per year. Semi-detached, something like, 44, 45. And a mid-terrace, about 40 kilowatt hours per square meter per year. And other house types, you know, we can discuss. But, I mean, this gives you an idea about where we need to go. Of course, there are advantages to doing renovation. It's not just about carbon and saving the planet. Most people do it, who have contacted me to help them do that for comfort. They're tired of living in an old house. They decided they're not going to move. They've got a pension pot they're going to spend it on. They just need to figure out what they're going to do. So people do it, and most people do it for comfort, to be able to have 20 degrees all the time and not lose the heat. And we can also save the planet. That's also good. Indoor air quality is very good. So when you have a ventilation system, it keeps your carbon dioxide levels in check. So you're more efficient if you're doing a lot of work. If you use your house for work, you'll be much more efficient when you've got a ventilation system. It regulates your humidity, stale odors, and, you know, that kind of thing. Drying laundry, very, very quick. You don't have to open windows and put it out, laundry outside. You don't have to use a tumble dryer. It's all quite good. Lower ongoing bills, of course. And health improves. So people with respiratory problems, asthma, find that a ventilation system with heat recovery, ventilation system in general, is it helps to keep mites and those kind of things at bay. We tend to have a sort of relative humidity of somewhere between 40 and 60% when we've got a ventilation system going. If not, it might be 70, 80% or something. Mold likes to sort of start to linger around 80% humidity. And the cold, the closer you get to a cold surface, the more the humidity goes up, and that's where you might get the mold starting. So conclusions before we have a bit of banter. We're responsible for what we know. The climate is breaking down. So what are we going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? That's the question. And it's a very difficult thing because we're living in these houses. What do we do about it? do about it? I mean, maybe you just renovated the kitchen last year and put lovely tiles and whatever, but it's very, very cold and useless. But it might look very nice. But what are you going to do about that now? It's really hard to sort of figure that out. But I don't think, you know, with the climate problem, it's not about cost considerations anymore or other considerations. Like if you think, oh, I can't afford a retrofit. Well, what did you afford recently that was a huge amount of money? You know, maybe a car or maybe a new conservatory or, whatever. So I think some of us can, not all of us can though. And there's no easy solution. We just saw it's a real hassle. So what are your options? One, get overwhelmed by the state of the planet and do nothing, and hope it will all resolve itself or that the government will come up with a solution. or perhaps do a bit of dabbling with loft insulation or maybe recycle something, you know. Or turn down your thermostat and live in a very cold house. It's also possible. Or take the bull by the horns and do a retrofit, which is a bit of a nightmare. It's hassle, upheaval. But you can do it in phases, like I was saying. You can do it DIY and you can plan it. If you plan it, you can do it. It might be a bit overwhelming. I mean, the modern 1990s house, the guy who started that, he said at the beginning he was just so far out of his comfort zone when he was starting off, it was not funny. But once they just start, they started with the utility room, very small, just think, well, let's see, you know. And actually, it's okay. You get it after a while. Just need a bit of support and just sort of, you know, you can do it. So what else can we do? Oh, yes, so if you want to know about the nitty-gritty, if you haven't had enough, I'll be over there at 8. I've got some bits of some toys here and we'll play around, and I've got a presentation and I've got a computer and a little projector and I've got lots of photographs and bore you to tears with that. But, you know, if you want to know the details on 5 key areas, so good insulation, what does air tightness and wind tightness mean? Thermal bridge-free design or mitigating thermal bridges, how do you do that? High-quality windows and doors. And ventilation with heat recovery. Those are really the 5 key main areas that we need to tackle about when we're looking at renovation. So I'll be over there. If you want to know the nitty-gritty, come over there and we'll have a bit more of a sort of informal discussion. I've got lots of material, but it's not going to be really me talking at you. I think I'd like to find out what people want to know, and then we'll go from there. And while you're at it, you're doing a retrofit, phased retrofit, but don't just do that. You could also change your electricity supply, get it on a totally renewable tariff, so like Good Energy or something like that, which has proven that they generate the renewable electricity and you buy it. Maybe just don't. I just was reading yesterday these REGOs, these renewable energy guarantee of origin certificates, that so like E.ON has suddenly gone from 40 something percent renewables to 100% overnight, because they can basically buy certificates from somewhere and say that they're providing renewable electricity, but they just don't. And it's bizarre how this country works. I don't quite understand how it's possible that you, because that electricity hasn't been produced, but a certificate has been sold somehow and they're allowed to. I just don't understand. It's a very British thing, or it's a very English thing, why we allow loopholes like that. I don't get it, but anyway. If you want to know more about REGOs, there's a good blog on the Good Energy website that I was reading yesterday, so have a look. If you're on the E.ON tariff, for example, or on others. So it's not only about retrofit, of course. Retrofit is part of the solution, but we can do other things. So we all drive cars, probably. We need to switch to electric, probably, or stop driving. But I think in this country, we're probably always going to drive. The public infrastructure is not good enough. So we're going to be, a lot of us driving, so we have to drive electric. Yes, they need batteries. Yes, 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 yes. But we can't just keep driving, because that's even a bigger component of carbon emissions than housing. So that's another big win you can do. Go electric and then haggle with, nag, and hassle your local whoever, councillors, MP, whoever is in authority, to get EV charging, electric vehicle charging stations up, to what about retrofit, what about cycle lanes, what about everything, you know. And of course, we can do many other things. So this is somebody said, I was reading at some point, you know, every decision we make in life is about where we spend our money is a vote about the kind of world we want to live in. So, you know, that's houses, but it's also other things. It's about biodiversity. It's the kind of food we buy. And it's quite tiring to ask ourselves every single time, what about this? What about that? You know, do I need to drive here? Should I drive to work? Should I have to buy an electric car? Should I buy this stuff wrapped in plastic that's going to choke the whales? Are we, you know, or should I just let my stomach rumble and go and find something more sustainable? Am I going to buy organic food that doesn't have all the pesticides on it? That's, you know, what about intensively reared meat? What about, you know, it goes on and on and on. It's quite exhausting. So yes. And so we all make pragmatic choices, and myself included. You know, so everyone could say, and I even say, you know, like, oh, we do what we can do. We do what we can. And can we? Yeah, we do what we can, but it's really not good enough. And we're all making these decisions. Millions of us are making these decisions every day. And all those little pinpricks, it's not like the planet is dying by the big dagger stabs. It's dying by a million pinpricks. So we're all doing this stuff. So how do we, you know, so I don't have all those answers. But anyway, at least in terms of the housing, this one, we can start to get on top of. But it's not an easy thing to do. And that takes me to the end. So that wasn't bad, 45 minutes of me muttering at you. Maybe, if it's okay, for 15 minutes, if there are any questions here that is not, well, anything, we can have a discussion, a question. Otherwise, over there at 8 o'clock, I'll be back for some more mind-numbing mutterings.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Got myself a bit tangled. So we do have a bit of time for a Q&A. What I'm going to do is I'm going to try and get the mic as close to you as possible, but as you can see, this doesn't detach. So if you are able to come forward, we would really appreciate that. If not, feel free to tell the person next to you, or if there's a gap, shout it at me and I'll say it into the mic so that everybody can hear. So yeah, we got any questions? Yeah, is anyone able to come a little closer? Yeah?
So you just mentioned You mentioned at the end there buying an electric car as a sort of something else that you might be able to think about in terms of carbon footprint. I just didn't know whether you had, in terms of like two big potential capital expenditures, whether there was any sort of sense in priority between an electric vehicle or kind of retrofitting your home. And I suppose it might depend on lots of different factors, but I just wondered whether there was a sort of rule of thumb there.
I don't know. I'm just thinking of trying to buy a second-hand electric car myself, but I don't know. I know in general carbon emissions from cars is like a bit more than buildings in general of the whole thing, but it depends how much you drive, I suppose. But I suppose the more of us that nag and hassle and haggle, the more it might push it a bit that way. But I don't know. I wish I'd taken the note. There was a book recently, and I don't know the author, but it was a lady who was writing a book about what things can we do. What simple things can Joe Bloggs, can everyone do? And, you know, going electric in your vehicle was one of them. That's what I remember. But I can't remember the title of the book. And obviously other things like retrofit and so on. But I think it's a big gain. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right. But I'm no expert on EVs or electric yet.
Yeah. You got another question? There's loads of them.
So to put it into context, we have a house that we bought for about 180,000 that's about 92 square metres. And if you're looking at £1,000 per square metre, half the value of the house in retrofitting is A, we're in our mid-20s, is not money that we have. How would you prioritise? What would be the most important thing to do with a budget in mind?
Okay, so we'll cover that next session. But basically, in most retrofit things, houses, three main culprits for heat loss. If you're going to do some retrofit with a limited budget, what should you do? So external facing walls is usually the biggest culprit. So that means any walls facing outside air, inside house, you know, and whatever. And the more funny sort of shape you have, the more heat loss you'll have. So insulating those is a big one. Making it less drafty, That's usually number two in the heat. But if you've got lots of glazing, lots of windows, and sometimes that can be the second or even first place, depending. If the wall is a cavity and it's already insulated, is that the case? Then it's got the edge taken off it already, so it's probably coming into second place or even third place in terms of heat loss. And what about your windows? Are they
double glazed? Quite old.
So that's probably, and there's there a lot of it.
Our house is end of terrace.
End of terrace, so not that much. Yeah. And what? So. So some, that's probably going to be, I'm going to guess, the second place. How drafty is that? Not particularly, you don't? Yeah, so probably windows and doors and slash, you know, air leakiness is probably, I'm going to guess, if that was modelled and we actually did, it would probably be the first two. But these three are the top three culprits usually. But wall insulation is always worth doing if you can. But.
You also mentioned a heat pump. What is that? How does that work?
I'm not entirely sure myself. It's basically something like the actual mechanics of it. It's like a reverse fridge. So a fridge hums away, uses electricity to make the inside cold. A heat pump hums away and takes energy from the air and makes it warm into, you know, so it's like that idea. So if you, but of course that has to use electricity to function. But they have a coefficient of performance. So you put a bit of energy in and you get, three or four times the energy out. So they're kind of, but you still have to run it. So if you've got a house that's very leaky and useless and drafty and cold, a heat pump may not keep up with the demand, because heat pumps run at a lower temperature. So the radiators being 40, 50 degrees, something like that. But if their walls and floors and everything is leaking like crazy, then you won't feel comfortable. But that's basically what a heat pump is, and you can run it using a renewable tariff, possibly. So it's decarbonizing your heat source, if you like, instead of using gas.
Just before we have the next question, if anyone does want to ask a question that's not able to come and join the queue, please just wave madly at me, and I'll make sure that you do get an opportunity to ask it. Okay.
Okay. Thanks. A sort of trivial question, really. You said the payback would be very slow on a retrofit. Any evidence about uplift of the market value of the property once it's been done?
I haven't seen any, but one would hope. Yeah, one would hope. I mean, theoretically, there should be, but people seem to buy houses from the location and the number of chrome bath fittings and things, isn't it?
But I don't think it would completely cover all the costs, but it may just give you some sort of compensation.
Maybe. I don't know. I would hope so. But it's not quite in the general British psyche at the moment to have an energy efficient house, because we don't know what they are. So yeah, that people wouldn't buy that.
What was the name of the association you mentioned? ACB.
AECB.
AECB. And would they have the information on that you've been talking about this afternoon?
Yep. They do a blogging document. I mean, it's on their website called Can We Build Ourselves Out of the Climate Crisis? Which goes into these targets and how they got there. They were modeling the Green Party's. This is probably a policy. So it's publicly available. You can just go and check there. The ACB is good. ACB.net. And becoming, they have a conference or a meetup once a year or something, and they've got a lot of good literature there, and it's a good bunch of people trying to figure out what to do. So honestly, I'd recommend it's for an individual, it's about 50 quid a year, money well spent.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Eric. You seem to assume that we all heat our houses by gas. We recently got rid of our oil tank and converted to a wood burner. Now, wood burner, is that zero carbon?
This is another one.
It's the wood we use 2 years old.
Yeah.
So not so much smoke.
Yeah, it's not something I fully understand. Some people argue against biomass. They call it biomass. It's a recent carbon produced, yep, and then they burn it. I don't know whether that's better or not. I mean, it had been considered to be much better before in terms of carbon emissions, and then there's been some people arguing that maybe it's not. But I think in general, if we're looking at the whole of the UK, we don't have enough wood for everyone to go burning it. So that's probably the in larger scale, right, possibly the issue. But I think it's better than burning gas, because that's old stuff.
Yep.
But I don't know if that's the question you were asking.
Yeah.
And I'm not a biomass expert, and I know that there's been arguments both sides.
Yeah.
But again, it's go down a bit of the rabbit hole in terms of carbon and biomass and things, and it's still I'm learning on that. So. Yeah.
Well, we don't use gas at all. We just
literally... No, yeah.
Thanks.
Well, it's better than gas, I think, and oil.
You mentioned various sorts of house types. You didn't mention flats. Now, obviously, those of us who have flats, we have a certain... We have more constraints on what we can do. But I wondered if you could make perhaps some comments about what might be possible there, particularly because we're just about to start quite a big renovation of a flat, including putting in central heating for the first time. And then what sort of central heating would you recommend, and what would be priorities for a flat when we can't do anything that involves the whole building because of all the other people living there?
Okay, well, I haven't done a flat yet, so I don't know. But I could imagine, I mean, flats generally are even more efficient than terrace houses because you have only a little bit of external surface. And so they're very, very efficient. And some flats, they overheat and they always have to keep the window open because they get too much heat from the neighbors. So sometimes you don't have to do anything because it's too hot. But otherwise, it would be something to do with it depends if you're able to do something with the external facing wall and the window, that'll be your main heat loss there. If it's a flat, it might already have a ventilation system in it. I don't know. No, it's an old flat, is it? Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. But if it depends if the flat below is not occupied and it's cold, or the flat above or the flat on the side, then those are going to be colder walls, but not very, very cold, maybe 17 degrees on the other side, 16, 17 possibly if unoccupied, compared with when it's very close to zero outside. So it's not, you know, you've got less issues to worry about in an apartment compared with other houses. So worst case is detached and bungalow. Those are the hardest ones.
Yeah, we've done quite a lot on energy efficiency at home, but the next step we want to take is moving from a gas-fired central heating to a renewable form of heating. Could you suggest what we should do for that? And roughly, we're in a small-ish terraced house, the kind of cost, not obviously in ballpark figures, of doing that.
Yeah, so again, I'm learning about this all the time. That 1970s semi in Lancaster... she's putting in an air source heat pump now, so I'm learning as we go along with that. What that costs, I can't remember. I'll have to look in the computer. But
So this air sourced pump thing is...
Yeah, it seems like a lot of people go for... I mean, you could go for ground source heat pumps. It's basically coils of... you dig out... you've got to have a lot of ground, and you dig out and you put the coils of pipes in the ground. Or the other alternative is to drill a borehole quite deep, but those are quite expensive options, so a lot of people just go for something that looks like an air conditioning unit placed outside. It hums away and it takes some of the heat from the outside and puts it into a wet radiator system.
Right.
So it's your radiators then are becoming not boiling hot, but sort of warmish. Yeah. So you've got to do something to your building heat energy loss, so you can't have it too drafty and too much energy being lost, otherwise... No. That's...
Well, we've done quite a lot on the energy efficiency side, you know, and insulation and all the rest of it. So that was what we thought we should do next, because it will reduce the carbon footprint, won't it?
Yeah. And you can also, of course, you've got solar that can, solar panels that can give you electricity.
We've got solar for electricity, but it's our big, carbon thing is the gas central
heating. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So probably an air source heat pump.
Yeah.
But you could have it, you can have a diversion switch from your solar panels to, so when you don't, hang on, does that work? When you don't need all the electricity, it heats your hot water tank.
Right.
So you still need hot water all year, not just in the cold season. So that can be quite an efficient way to use your solar as well.
Okay, thank you.
But again, I'm learning about this all as I go along.
Just say these are the last two questions. Yeah, thank you.
Hi, so by the sounds of it, it is a lot like Mission Impossible, because I'm in that bracket. I've just been able to afford a house. There's no way that I can do anything to it, particularly in terms of retrofitting. Are there any incentives out there to encourage people to do this? If not, what can we be hassling government with and asking them for, if you, from your perspective, if not, presumably we go to the AECB to and see what they're asking for?
I mean, there should be incentives, but again, government seems to just dithering around, so I don't know. It's for many people, it's an impossible thing because they just don't have that finance. But that finance needs to be made available somehow. Otherwise, it's just impossible to do retrofit at scale. How that happens, I don't know. I mean, in Manchester, we're sort of coming, you know, that's one of the big barriers is finance. One of them is that, you know, the finance is one of the big barriers. And maybe something along the lines of green mortgages, where if a house could be proven that it has a certain energy demand, it could have a mortgage rate which was significantly lower interest to make it interesting, so that you could see after 25 years of mortgage term, I will have saved 40 grand instead of, you know, in my house, I bought it for about 80, and by the end of 25 years, I will have paid 160. But imagine if I had an agreement at the beginning to do a retrofit, and I would only then have an interest rate, so I'd pay 120 by the end, then I actually, that would have paid for the retrofit. Do you see what I mean? So I think something along those lines, the government has to produce that.
There needs to be something.
There needs to be something, otherwise it's mission impossible, and it's just a few of us sort of, greenbelt types that might just do dabbling here and there, just do people doing it, but it needs to happen on the masses. So without that, it's, I don't know, but hopefully soon.
And just as a sort of priority, is there a is it better to go for down the insulation route, or is it better to change to an air source heat pump? Is there one or the other that wins? Because a lot of people have probably done the insulation to some extent, whereas the air source heat pump, perhaps not many people have looked into.
I think it depends on how leaky and how much heat loss, how drafty your house is, and how much heat energy is being lost through the walls and roof. Because otherwise, the heat pump you will still not be comfortable, and you'll have to use a lot of electricity and cranks up and uses more. So there's a balance there. So it depends, I guess. Again, I'm not sure, even if it's maybe easier to say it depends, because also I'm not sure. I'd have to, again, I'm always learning new things. So when it comes to the benefit of doing one or the other, but I mean, really, I think both ideally. You'll always need a heat source, hopefully just not gas, you know, and we want to reduce the amount of energy we're using and losing. That's what we want to do. So both ideally, because in the end you want to be comfortable. This is the whole thing. If you talk about passive house, the whole principle of passive house is comfort, not just, so you can live in a cold freezing house and have this heat pump that's cranking away and trying to do something, but you're still uncomfortable. So the idea is to do something with a heat loss, as in especially drafts, because when you have draft, that's the thing that makes you feel most uncomfortable. As well as if you're sitting next to a single glazed window, you'll feel cold radiant coming from that, so you'll feel uncomfortable. But the idea would be to do some fabric measures to feel comfortable and then have a renewable heat source together.
Hello. From a lot of things that people have been saying, a book I would recommend is the Haynes Manual of, I can't quite remember the title, but it's something like refurbishing your house or saving energy in your house. That would really help lots of people. But what I was going to say is, you've said your calculations of 80 to 100 years payback, but maybe you could do a couple of calculations where presumably energy prices are going to increase phenomenally, and at that point it isn't 80 to 100 years payback, it'd be more like 25 to 30, and that might make the difference.
Yeah, it definitely will, yeah. I mean, that 80, 100 years was based on assuming you would put your money into the bank at a certain interest rate, so it was not a simple payback as well. But then who knows what energy prices will do. We said, by now it should be crazy high energy price, and it's still quite low. So who knows? So those kind of payback calculations anyway, it's like, well, it's economics anyway, it's a bit of a nonsense. So I don't know. But it's better not to even to get into that probably. But focus on comfort. People want to be comfortable. So how can you do that? Get rid of your drafts, stop your cold radiant and hot radiant discomfort from uninsulated pitch roofs in the bedroom upstairs, which feels boiling hot in the summer or too cold in the winter. Cold windows because it's single glaze and so on. So we're trying to focus a little bit on making people to do it because they should be comfortable.
Thank you very much. Thank you to Eric for opening our venue this weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. At Greenbelt, we make a space where artistry meets activism, where the political meets the practical, where the sacred meets the secular. We think we're somewhere to dream up a better world, to dance and debate, to pray and to party. Visit greenbelt.org.uk to browse and download other great thinking from our recorded catalogue. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.